Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 5th of July 2015. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James, Phil from the West End Whingers, and Nick from Partially Obstructed View. We're now going to talk about the trial at the Young Vic. This is an adaptation of Franz Kafka's novel, and it's been adapted by Nick Gill, and it's been directed by Richard Jones, who has quite a history at the Young Vic. He's done Public Enemy, Government Inspector, Annie Get Your Gun, Good Soul of Sichuan, Hobson's Choice, and The Six Characters in Search of an Author. So he certainly likes remaking the Young Vic. I mean, I seem to remember that a lot of those, he's given us a sort of almost proscenium arch in two of them, great big wooden structures. And again, we get a wooden structure in this play, which is fairly interesting and also an interesting way of staging it. It's about a young man called Joseph Kay, played by Rory Kinnear, and he is one day woken up and told that he's on trial for an unspecified crime. And he goes through trying to work out why he's on trial, what he's on trial for, and just going through the process of the trial. Now, most recently, this was, I think, done at the Gate Theatre a couple of years ago, I think, adapted by Tom Basden, and starring Tom Basden, Sean Brooke, Pip Carter, and Tim Key. This one, as I said, has Rory Kinnear, Richard Kant, Sarah Crowden, Kate O'Flynn, Sean Thomas, and Hugh Skinner, amongst other people, and is somewhat different. Gareth, tell me all about it and what you thought of it.
Well, Kafka wrote the novel exactly 100 years ago. It's actually a centenary of him writing the novel, although it wasn't published until after he died 10 years later. So the novel was actually first published in 1925. I don't think the novel has ever sort of had the status in the UK as it has in other European countries. I mean, it's been named second and third in 20th century best novels in both France and Germany. I think it's more iconic in other countries. It's got a dark, bleak quality that German works often do. I mean, he's Czech, but I think it was written in German. And the adaptation by Nick Gill is no less dark and no less bleak. But the production is quite striking, really. And I think the production does actually give it new meaning to a sort of 21st century non-German audience. And it starts with, well, I guess it depends where you're sitting, but certainly if it's sitting in the lower half of the house, it starts with quite a disorientating walk to your seat, which is a kind of jury bench. And you're facing this orange platform, which has a giant keyhole cut into it. And that rises to sort of reveal the playing space. And Richard Jones and Miriam Werter always have a big idea. And their big idea this time is to stage the play on a sort of conveyor belt. And I know lots of people have made references to the Generation Game in talking about it. So it's a kind of traverse setting, and this conveyor belt is going from left to right or right to left, depending on which side of the traverse you are. And everything enters, rides along, stops, and leaves on this conveyor belt. You know, the fairly sort of sparse sets, the characters. And I think in a way that is very effective because Joseph K, it's his 30th birthday, and he's following this personal nightmare, this kind of journey, and the conveyor belt does take us on that kind of journey. And he's navigating this faceless system. We don't know what it is. We don't know what his crime is. The offense is never specified. You know, we could be in a totalitarian state. It could be a giant bureaucracy. It could even be a corporation, if you take a modern spin on it. Anywhere where you can get lost, I guess, in this sort of confusing world around you, really. It's done in two unbroken hours, although it does move speedily through his nightmare. And we meet sort of lots of people along the way, really. Nick Gill's big idea, because he's got one too in the adaptation, is that he's given Joseph K a kind of inner language, which is a sort of pidgin English or shorthand, which he speaks when he's alone, when he's doing his monologues. And I thought that emphasized his sort of personal nightmare quite well. The closing scene, which I won't give away, is a sort of particularly modern take on Joseph's end. That was quite clever as well. The chief reason for seeing this for me is that it's a real tour de force performance from Rory Kinnear, who's on stage, or rather on the conveyor, all of the time. And I think he just, you know, he's really good at kind of laying bare, you know, his psychological torture, his helplessness, and he's making a fairly challenging physical journey while he's doing this as well. It's a very, very good ensemble. Kate Flynn transforms herself into, I think, six different female characters, which he does remarkably. I really like Sean Thomas, who does very different things as both a lawyer and a doctor. And then Hugh Skinner, who plays a couple of roles I thought was very good as well. It's very hard to shake off Hugh Skinner's last role, which was Will in W1A. So it's very hard to do that, but I think he did very well. I think it does push its luck at 2 hours, to be honest. I did feel the 2 hours, and it's not something you'd say was a good night out. But it's challenging, and if you'd like to go to the theatre and be challenged, I think it's, you know, it's a rewarding experience, if not perhaps entertaining experience. And I do think it sort of does resonate quite a bit today as a sort of picture of how we can get lost in a system, really, whatever that system might be. And I wonder whether it might mean different things to different people, you know, that it might sort of, in a way, you might bring your own experiences and your own phobias to the play. And I think that might be the case. I haven't talked to enough people about their views of it to know that, really. But, you know, in the sense of staging and performance, it's fairly unmissable theatre, whatever you think about Kafka and whatever you think about his novel now play.
John, what did you think?
Well, for me, it's all conveyor belt and no cuddly toy. I commend the idea to the house that everyone should read Phil Winger's review. I'm sorry he's not here to join us this weekend to talk about it, but the westendwingers.com review of The Trial is itself hilarious and a great piece of theatre. The point that he makes, and that I think I make as well, is that if I have a prediction about The Trial, it's that every reviewer will mention the conveyor belt and 3 out of 5 of them will link it to the Generation Game. As Gareth said, the auditorium has been completely gutted. And what it's been rebuilt with is like stacks and stacks and stacks of plywood framed juror seating. And that really does engage you because you are forced to be part of the observance and the judgment of the piece. And in fact, as Joseph Kay, Rory Kinnear frequently doesn't exactly break the fourth wall, but he refers to being watched by the neighbours. And we are therefore the neighbours as well as those set in judgment above him. And it's another Miriam Boother set. She is fantastically versatile and energetic designer and, you know, famous for Earthquakes in London and Anna Nicole, the opera at Covent Garden. And I think hasn't she also done Bend It Like Beckham? Very, very busy and engaged designer. And it's a very, very clever set. But like all Richard Jones productions, and especially all Richard Jones productions in The Young Vic, it wants you to know that it's clever. And, you know, this is the man who gave us Annie Get Your Gun seen through a 40-foot letterbox, and I really haven't forgiven him for ruining a classical piece like that. Some people would say he's ruined this classical piece, but I don't think it has the same kind of affection and following that a big and popular stage musical does. And again, as Gareth points out, it's not so much in the British consciousness as many other 100-year-old works from Bernard Shaw or somebody like that. I found parallels with Headlong's production of 1984 that was at the Almeida and then transferred to the Playhouse last year, I think. And like 1984, I think The Trial is far easier to read than to stage. And I also think that such a sort of historical literary oeuvre here has that sort of texture of diligent dramatisation or slightly open university. And I'm afraid it made my mind wander. It didn't grip me from the outset, even though, you know, like lots of people, I would walk over glass to watch Rory Kinnear strut his stuff, and he does it very well indeed. He's a terrific actor. But, you know, this isn't Iago, and he doesn't draw you in the way that he has done on many other occasions. So, you know, there are no ceiling tiles, so in their absence, I counted the audience, which is 372, if anybody's interested, and then pondered for quite a long while whether the juror sitting behind me was actually Jake Gyllenhaal, because he really was a very close lookalike if he wasn't. So maybe Richard Jones is making some brilliantly surreal dramatic point, because Kafka's book is all about being involved in something very difficult that you can't either influence or stop, and without actually knowing what's going on. So for me, the production did that very well, up to a point. And then a point came, I would say, about hour and a quarter through it, maybe, when it really did catch me up and get me involved. And I think some of the Ancira performances were the ones that did it for me, particularly Sean Thomas, an actress I admire very much indeed, playing a sort of helmet-haired lawyer who has all the mannerisms and the patronising and the clipped and fleet speech. Can speech be both clipped and fleet while she manages it? of the profession, but actually talking nonsense. It is quite surreal. And of course, it's a point that Kafka is making because he had a deep and abiding hatred of the legal profession. And then the other ancillary performance that really got me was Hugh Skinner, who we all know and I think love as the gauche and love-struck personal assistant Will from BBC's W1A, and his little catchphrases have really gone into national consciousness. But here he shows an ability that transcends the little role he's been given on the BBC. And I think he has potential to be, you know, a comic but serious actor, maybe in the mould of Hugh Laurie or somebody like that. But I think there's much more to be drawn out of this young man. And it's a very interesting performance to watch because not only does he play a kind of young, thrusting executive, you know, sort of corporate knobhead you'd find almost anywhere in the city. And again, perfecting the speech of corporate nonsense in the same way that Sean Thomas does with the legal stuff. But he's also a sort of disheveled tramp-like character, and he has to alternate these two through several different scenes. So he must be putting on and taking off the suit and the unsocked shoes all the time. Some of the other performances I found curious. There's a background ensemble, almost like a Greek chorus, of older actors who form, for example, the queue in the waiting room where Joseph K goes to meet some officials who actually might help him pursue his case. And they're also in the background of a lot of the other scenes. And I wonder whether they really were actors hired for the occasion or whether there was any way anybody over 60 could sign up to go and do it, because they're mostly silent roles. And I think that'd be a great way of introducing some more revenue into this piece if you were allowed to come and turn up in a dirty Mac and a headscarf and scribble notes on the wheelie bin, which is what they do for quite a lot of the time. The performance I didn't like, I have to say, is Kate O'Flynn. I didn't like her in Taste of Honey either, with Leslie Sharp at the National. And she has that sort of irritating brightness that puts you in mind of Sally Hawkins, but then without Sally Hawkins' comic abilities. And as you say, she plays a lot of secondary female characters, one of which may or may not be flirting with Joseph K. And I didn't find that the characters she played were sufficiently delineated. Although that may again be production trick. Perhaps you're meant to think that all the women who pass, all the younger women who pass through his life are effectively one projection of his own. The other thing I really couldn't get my head around was the gobbledygook language that Joseph K's monologues are often presented in, especially when he's thinking back to his teenage years or having other flashbacks. And they are so much the fractured comic language of 60s, 70s comedian Professor Stanley Unwin, who once described Elvis Presley as a waspy waist and swivel hippie. It's just the sort of staccato, fractured language that Kinnear is being made to use in Nick Gill's adaptation. And it got in the way for me of completely sympathising with the character and getting it. And, you know, is he meant to have had a stroke? What is he going through here? I also wanted the climax. Gareth has hinted at it, and I'm not going to reveal it, but I wanted it to be more visceral, because in the book he ends up skewered on a knife, which he almost throws himself on. And whilst this is more modern, it is less dramatically conclusive than the book. But I have to say, very interesting, really, you know, bright and beautiful staging, visually distinctive, but then what? It's really the question you have to ask. And maybe Tim can give us some answers.
Yeah, the thing I had, I mean, I certainly noticed the Stanley Unwin stuff, although the other thing, of course, that it reminded me of was Rory Kinnear's father in practically every Richard Lester film that Rory Kinnear's father, Roy, was ever in, because he's always muttering. In if you ever watch the plays and pay attention to what Roy Kinnear is doing, he basically does an awful lot of muttering to himself. So there is that kind of remembrance of that. But we do have a fantastic performance, I think, by Rory Kinnear, who is, you know, one of our best actors. And I did understand, I mean, he has been interviewed and has explained what the idea of this broken, fractured speech is, and it is the kind of thing when you're in your head, you're never actually speaking in fluent sentences. You're always speaking sort of catches and phrases because your mind just fills everything in. So that's, I think that's the idea that Nick Gill had when when writing it. So it kind of worked for me. The thing that doesn't really work for me is that I read the novel, and the novel goes over quite a long time, but is actually relatively short, I seem to recall. And when I saw it in adaptation, it was also done quite short. This is 2 long hours, and it feels it. And it really... I just wish they'd, you know, get on with it. They're just filling it out, and they're fattening it up a little bit too much for my taste. I wanted a bit more, perhaps a little bit more, well, a little bit less of the infill, and a little bit more sharpness to it, and a little bit more plot. I mean, it's not really something with an awful lot of plot in it. In the end, I think I enjoyed it, but I had serious reservations about it. I would like it to be a lot tighter, a lot more efficient, and really a lot more plot, but perhaps there is too much opportunity for people sort of filling out their parts. And yeah, I almost wanted clear characterization in it that you recognized the weird stuff, because you can't expect this to be sort of clearly plotted, because it's not the point of it. The point of it is that he is faced up against this sort of amorphous bureaucracy, and you can't do it. But within the bits, I wanted the characters to be a bit more clearly delineated and a bit more proper creations of the actors. I mean, you certainly get that with Sharon Thomas's work, and you certainly get that with Hugh Skinner's work. And Cato Flynn just has too many roles to play, which is a big problem. And it just sort of takes away. You're not sure which one she's being now, and you're not entirely sure who they are a lot of the time. I just couldn't work out who the schoolgirl was, or the cleaner. I thought I'd gone to sleep and missed the scene when he suddenly starts talking to the cleaner who flirts with him. And I thought, did I miss a scene? Because he's referring to something, and I'm sure it wasn't. I haven't just seen that. What's going on? And there's all sorts of bits and pieces like that that you wanted a slightly. The characterizations need to be clear, even if the overall plot can be mysterious. And I just think I missed out on that. In spite of saying that we wouldn't be able to get him, we have been able to get Phil from the West End Whingers. Phil, tell me more about this and what you thought of it, although we've probably said everything you thought of it beforehand.
Yeah, you pretty much said everything that I thought. And I'm definitely more with John than with Gareth. I think for the first sort of 10, 15 minutes, I was very intrigued by the staging of it, which is you know, it's very different. But the problem I had was that I actually didn't really feel the menace. It didn't come through for me. And I wasn't particularly that impressed with the acting, strangely enough. I thought it was a rare sort of mishit for Rory Kinnear, in my opinion. I think he sort of struggled with against the staging. I think they all did to a certain extent. I mean, I love him, love Sean Thomas. I felt they were sort of lost. I thought, again, like it was already been said, that a lot of the characters weren't properly developed around him. I did like Hugh Skinner, and when he appeared, I thought, well, hang on a minute, this is going to be something that this is going to pep it up, because he was quite funny, and he plays two quite well-defined different characters, but he only has two characters to do, whereas Cato Flynn had too many, and I agree that she really couldn't do much with them. I thought Michael Billington's review of this was actually very funny. It's because he's done a sort of thing as though he is Michael B, as in Joseph K, the character, and was being forced to go and see this production, which he obviously didn't like, and it was just too gimmicky. I mean, I felt it was too gimmicky for me. And like John, I sat there because it's so brightly lit, and you can see the people on the other side of the travelator in the middle. I was surveying their faces for boredom, and there were plenty who looked bored like me. And I started counting the seats just to wonder how many people they actually managed to fit it in. And if it was a big success, would they transfer it? And how could they transfer it? Because of the nature of the staging. And it would have to be done like that. You couldn't put it into proscenium. So, yeah, there's not really an awful lot that I can add, except the fact that, you know, I found it very punishing. And I don't know if that was deliberate to sort of put us, you know, in the situation of Joseph K in a way, and just sort of wonder what the hell was going on. But that's how I felt. And there's no real escape from it.
We're now going to talk about Hang at the Royal Court. This has been written and is directed by Debbie Tucker Green. It stars Marianne Jean-Baptiste, Claire Rushbrook and Shane Zaza. We are set in some kind of a government institution where a woman is waiting to talk to a couple of functionaries who are related in some way, I think, to the police or the criminal justice system. Nick, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Yeah, so this is, the characters don't have names. They're kind of numbered in the order that they speak in the script. But Marianne Chompty's character is a mother whose one of her children was murdered a few years back. And she's been called to this government office for a couple of reasons. One is that there's been some minor developments in the case and that the killer has actually written a letter to her that she may or may not want to read through. But there is also a kind of a bigger reason that she's been called back, because she's had a decision to make over the last couple of years. And she's been called in to say what she's decided to do, because this is kind of an alternate reality where the kind of the victims of crime or the families of the victims have a say in the punishment. And that's kind of the high concept in Debbie Tucker Green's play. And it's an interesting high concept. And also, I think what's fascinating about the way she's dealt with that idea is to make it very much about a bureaucracy, and to kind of bring it down to this kind of very banal level. The setting, as you say, is sort of this meeting room in a kind of anonymous government building. There's the set, which is kind of a raised platform. It's designed by John Bowser, and it's got this sort of corridor, like a sort of bridge leading off to backstage, where every time the sort of door opens, you can hear office noises. So it is this kind of, it's this little world, but it's in the middle of quite a dull sort of office environment. So it's quite an interesting contrast between the kind of huge issues that the play is dealing with and the way it's presented. And I think that's very interesting. The fact that it kind of comes back to a family who've lost a son is kind of comes back to some of the themes of Random, the monologue that Debbie Tucker Green wrote a few years back. But this is that sort of dealt with the things at the time of the crime. This is sort of looking back at the way it's affected people, the effect of the famine, and kind of torn it apart a few years down the line. And that's kind of where a lot of the power of the piece comes from, because you've got Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who's a fantastic actress and absolutely brilliant in this, as you'd imagine. She's just kind of a bundle of rage and frustration. And the way it's shown up with the two civil servants, one and two, played by Claire Rushbrook and Shane Zaza. And I think this to me is also very nicely kind of done, nicely written. Again, very well acted, but I think it's interesting how they're also pretty sympathetic figures, because they're kind of, they're following a script, essentially. I think they're maybe not hugely experienced in having to deal with people who've had a loss like this, but that is their job, and they are sort of following instructions, and they've been on courses, and it's all very generic and not really going to be much use to somebody like Three, which is Jean-Baptiste's character, but they have to go through with it. So I think it's also a very sympathetic portrayal of kind of people in those sort of jobs who really can't be of much use, but you know, somebody has to do that job. So yeah, without trying to give away too much about it, it's a fascinating piece, I think, and it's definitely one that sticks in your memory. What do you think, Gareth?
Yes, I think it's a very powerful piece of theatre. It reminded me in some ways, not in terms of subject matter, but in terms of how it uses structure and style, and indeed brevity, because it's only an hour long. It reminded me of the Mike Barter plays, Game and Ball in particular, in that it kind of heightens the emotional impact of the subject matter in all sorts of ways, and really presents you with a kind of morality play. It presents you with, you know, a debate, a moral debate. And I kept, throughout the play, and indeed beyond the play, I kept thinking, what would I do? And that was its power, really. It sort of presented me with what seemed like, maybe today it's not something that would happen, but it could in another, you know, at another time or in another place happen, that we might have to make such a decision. And I think that's its success, in that it sort of presents you with this debate and really makes you think about what you might do in that situation. And I think the impersonality both of the setting, you know, because this kind of, you know, this is a kind of anywhere public sector meeting room. We've all been there, you know, under those kind of fluorescent lights and the water cooler in the corner. And there's an incredible impersonality to it. It's also a vast space because he's used sort of mirrors and brought lighting out into the audience. He sort of created, you know, quite a sort of cavernous, very cold kind of space. And then you've got these functionaries who, you know, in an impossible job. I mean, as Nick says, you know, they've been trained and they're following procedures, and their sort of clumsiness in a way, and that's not, you know, they are sympathetic characters, so they're not clumsy in any way other than they're just following procedures in a situation where probably following procedures isn't gonna have the empathy that you might need in that situation. And I think the fact that, you know, they have a difficult job to do and are kind of clumsy in doing it, and indeed are not in harmony with one another because they sort of contradict each other a bit, which frankly all makes matters worse. And I think the impersonality of the handling of the situation and the environment in which this is done actually does kind of, you know, heighten it even more, really. So it's not a play you could say you like, but it is a play, you know, I think I'm certainly very glad I went to see, because it really sort of provoked a lot of thinking and a lot of soul searching in a way. And as Nick says, I mean, Marianne Jean-Baptiste is sensational in that central role, but it must be hard to play against that in a way. And I really thought that Claire Rushbrook and Shane Zaza did that very well. I think it's, you know, it's difficult in that kind of situation to play against what is clearly a role that the play revolves around, and indeed an actress at the sort of top of her game, really. But I thought they did that very well. So I think the whole thing was very well crafted, you know, from design through direction and performance. And I think a very interesting play. And I was just really glad to leave the Royal Court main house thinking, well, that's a great show. And actually sort of seeing them, frankly, a bit back on form, really. So I'd recommend it very much.
Yeah, I was a little bit torn. I mean, I like Debbie Tucker Green's work, and I thought this was a good piece of it. And the way that, as people have said, the kind of institutional trying to be kind, trying to be helpful, but not, but they've got to obey all the rules, that kind of feel that you had to it, that worked particularly well. And of course, she always does this, the rage of the victim, which is, you see in other of her plays very well. And Marion Jean-Baptiste did it very well. But I think one of the central things was I just didn't believe the setup, you know, the alternate reality where the victim is determining punishment in some way. And I didn't really believe that. And it's sort of a little bit too science fiction for me. She sort of set the world up for this argument rather than dealing with an argument in a real world. And that I did have slight problems with. But overall, I mean, it's always a pleasure to see Marion Jean-Baptiste. And this was and also Debbie Tucker Green is always a playwright worth seeing. We're now going to talk about Luna Gale at the Hampstead Theatre. This is a play by Rebecca Gilman and is directed by Michael Attenborough. It stars Sharon Small as a social worker called Caroline, and also stars Alexander Arnold, Caroline Faber, Ed Hughes, Corey Johnson, Rachel Redford, fresh from Closer earlier this year, and Abigail Rhodes. One thing about Rebecca Gilman I'd like to mention is that she is a writer I admire a lot, and she managed to mess up rom-coms for me, romantic comedy films for me. She wrote a play called Boy Gets Girl, which is all about a woman being stalked by somebody, and one of the people in it, sort of commenting on the situation, puts out possibly a well-rehearsed and well-tried argument that an awful lot of rom-coms are the sort of narratives that go through stalkers' heads, especially the ones where a woman is going to marry somebody and she meets the new guy and the new guy pesters her and then she leaves the other guy. That kind of rom-com, I can't watch that now because of what Rebecca Gilman did. And actually, I did find myself watching one the other day and finding my flesh was beginning to creep because I was so turned off by the whole thing. It wasn't a particularly good rom-com, but yes, she has changed my life, and it's odd for a writer to do that in quite this sense. I'm not sure that this play changed my life. Gareth, tell me more about it, and did it change yours?
Well, I wouldn't say it changed my life. It's a bit dramatic. But I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to, because it was one of those plays that I didn't read in reviews because I don't when I've already booked for something. But you can't help the sort of star ratings kind of passing your eyeline, really. And that had, you know, the kind of indifference, I suppose, of the critics had sort of lowered my expectations. And it was a lot better than that. So I did enjoy the play very much. It's set in the US. I mean, Rebecca Gilman is an American playwright. It's set in the US and it revolves around Caroline, who's a social worker who specializes, I guess, in child protection. I think they call it the human services department in the play. And because of her job, she has some pretty monumental decisions to make, because she can, even though she doesn't make final decisions, things go to courts. You know, depending on what she recommends and says will depend upon where a child lives and who the child lives with. And Luna Gale is actually the name of a child. It's one of those names that young or immature people would give to their children, not thinking what it'll mean in years to come. And Luna's young parents, their drug taking is out of control, and Caroline has to intervene, both to find a short-term solution, because the child has to be taken into care straight away, but also to find a long-term solution as well. And the child's grandmother, who is kind of estranged from her daughter, wants custody. And initially, she just wants the temporary custody, which indeed she's given. But actually, then we find she wants the long-term, the permanent custody. And she's got very strong religious beliefs that are driving her, and the pastor who's helping her. Whilst the child's in temporary care, the parents are given some counselling and rehab. Well, not really rehab, because there's not a lot available, really, but they go into kind of groups. But it's really second-rate stuff, and it's not really dealing with the issues of the parents. Caroline herself is very overloaded. She's got a boss who's very much an administrator and not a social worker, who doesn't really understand this world very much. So Caroline is the sort of the one with experience. And the boss is kind of driven by different things. I mean, Caroline really wants to do the right thing, although sometimes her act, what she actually does is a bit questionable. But her boss really is driven by the expediency of the budget and the financial considerations and indeed the rules and the importance for him of following the rules. So the objectivity of both Caroline and her boss does come into question during the play. And Caroline also has a bit of a propensity to get personally involved in her cases. And we learn that through a subplot of another character who is seemingly a success story. And we also discover that Caroline herself has personal baggage. And that sort of comes out during the play as well, really. So I think she's trying to do the right thing, but sometimes she crosses some ethical lines in trying to do so. It is set in the US, but I think it just, you know, it could very easily be set here, really. And what I liked about it, I think, was that it just does cover a lot of very important issues. And I thought it covered them very effectively without taking sides, because Caroline is both a sympathetic character, but also one, you know, you have to question some of what she does. And she uses some sort of twists and devices in order to bring out all of these issues. And some of them do seem a bit contrived, I have to say, but they are... they do make the audience gasp on a number of occasions in the behavior that's actually going on here. And they do facilitate, you know, a really interesting discussion of what I think is a very, very important subject. I think the only gripe I had with the play was that there are lots of scenes. And even though Lucy Osborne's design is very good, the scene changes are very slow. And I think that kind of robs the play of some pace and therefore robs the play of some tension. But notwithstanding that, I mean, it did keep me, you know, I didn't sort of wander myself. It did hold me for the duration, really. It is very, very well performed. Now, I mean, I've liked Sharon Smore for a long time, and I think she's very good in this. And it's a different sort of role to I've seen her play before. And I think she sort of very, it's a difficult role because it's quite a complicated journey, really, emotionally, I think, Caroline. And I think she does that very well. And Alexander Arnott, who plays the young parent, the young father, Peter, I thought was really outstanding. And I haven't seen him before. I think he's done one other thing at the Hampstead Theatre, but a relative newcomer. And I thought his transition from a sort of incoherent mess when we first meet him to a sort of more responsible dad later on, I thought was extremely well handled. And as you mentioned, Rachel Redford, who we saw quite recently in Closer, this is a very different role for her, I think, and a more complex character, I think. She plays the child's daughter, Carly. And I thought that was a very impressive performance as well, really. So, you know, whether it was partly because my expectations had been lowered or whether it's just because I think it is a good play, I think it's a good play. And I've recommended it to a number of people since then. And it is, I think, the fifth Gilman play I've seen. And maybe what I ought to do in future is just trust my own instinct and experience and not really what the critics might believe, because I certainly think it's better than what they did. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, I also didn't, much the same as you, I don't go out of my way to see what critics think. I actually try to avoid it, but you do get general impressions of what people think. So again, I kind of came into this possibly not expecting very much, which I think can be quite useful. It was certainly a lot better than I was expecting, based on kind of, I don't know, I got a general feeling of sort of shrugging and sort of going meh around it, which I can kind of understand it, because there have been better plays written on the subject, but that's not to say this isn't worth a look as well. For me, I think it is quite mixed. I think some of the plot twists are a bit too soapy for me, and I think that whole subplot with the girl who's turned 18 and seems to be a success story, I think that's very underwritten and sort of, or maybe not underwritten, but it doesn't feel very well integrated into the main plot. But then I think there are other elements of it, as you say, that just made the audience gasp. And I, going into the interval, there's kind of a big sort of cliffhanger, which I kind of thought, well, I know how this is going to turn out, and I didn't. So that's always pleasing when, you know, you think you're going in for a fairly obvious way things are going to turn out, and you don't get that. So for me, it's not something I would say was unmissable, but I'm very glad I did see it. And yeah, I think there's some very good performances in there. I've not always been as big a fan of Sharon Small, but I really liked her in this. I didn't like her very much in the thing at the RSC she did last year, but this I thought was a lot better. And yeah, I think Alexander Arnold's the other one who really stands out. I think the thing about that role that he's playing is, as it goes on, you kind of see the things he's been doing previously that seemed, you know, that kind of made him look one way. You find out more about what was going on, and you kind of see him in a different light and see what he's been doing in a different light. And I think that he brings across very well. He is memorable enough that you kind of are able to look back over the play and go, okay, that's not what it appeared to be at the start. So yeah, I think it's definitely better than people have been giving it credit for. I don't think it's quite spectacular, but it's a strong piece on the subject. And yeah, it's actually just going back to what Tim was saying about Rebecca Gilman making a comment about rom-coms. It's funny because it was at Hampstead like last month, basically, that Sunspots was on there, which is an incredibly stalky rom-com. So it's funny that it's at the same venue. As for this one, I think it's worth a look. I think going in with low expectations is probably the best plan, because it does kind of impress a bit more than that.
Yeah, as I said, I will always go to see a Rebecca Gilman play, because I'm kind of a convert to the way she is. I don't think this is the best thing of hers I've ever seen. It is, as you said, there are quite a lot of longers between each individual scene, and it could be done in a snappier way. That's largely because of the set changes. But there is also a problem I had with, which I found, I wanted more of the personal from Sharon Small. I keep wanting to say Sharon Stone. I wanted more of that. You sort of get it intimated towards the end of it, but at first she just seems to be this perfect social worker who always wants to do the right thing, and always heard what she wants to do at any given point is always the right thing to do. And I think that's the risk of, because of the Christian thing, you probably can't say it, but there is this idea that she's a bit too much of a saint for me. I found her a bit, I didn't feel that she was, that she was driven by any personal motives, that she was, it was all professionalism and all the right thing, and she had her experience, and I didn't really buy that, or at least I didn't buy that as a real person. I wanted her to be a much more real person. I mean, she is, in this play, she is completely alone and completely isolated, which you kind of realise, but she's so self-sufficient that she seems to have got everything under control. But you do realise after a time that there is no one around her, and she is alone, and you don't feel enough that this is sort of impinging on her, which perhaps it is. And I would have liked to have seen a more personal side to her than than we saw in this play. I mean, that was a dissatisfaction, but I, you know, overall, I liked the play. I liked it a lot. I went before all the reviews came out, so I'm not aware of, I wasn't going to pay any attention to it, really. I think this is always a worthwhile play to see. She is a very interesting playwright, and anyway, so it's always worth seeing her plays, but I don't know that this is probably her best one.
I mean, the point you make about the Caroline, I actually thought that was quite cleverly handled, because I actually thought that her flaws did come out. And it seemed to me what she was doing was she was rule-breaking in order to do the right thing. So she had her own sort of expediency about it. And I actually didn't think she was as sympathetic a character overall, I think, as you might have done. And Nick's point about the subplot, I think, is a point well made, because I think that the subplot appears to exist only to say to us, look, she gets involved in her cases. And if that's the case, which I think it is, it's a quite long-winded way of saying she gets involved in her own cases or gets too personally involved. So I think in a way that the subplot is probably overcooked, because it's making a point that you could make either without it or indeed without spending quite so much time on it. But anyway, but interesting that we seem to be, you know, we seem to be on a similar page with it, and we seem to be more positive about it than the critics.
I did think, certainly for an American play, I was surprised at how much it kind of challenged the sort of the churches, because there's a real kind of, funnily enough, we didn't touch on that as much, but it's a major theme of the play, is the fact that the mother who may or may not be a fit guardian for her grandchild, it's down to kind of her religious beliefs and how extreme they are, but also the fact that the influence of the church and the suggestion that Caroline can't, she's kind of, anything she might say against the church is immediately pounced on, is, I think it really quite goes for the idea that kind of churches use their own freedom of not being persecuted to kind of persecute others. And there's a scene which, you know, shows kind of the church absolutely trying to bully her. There's no other word for it. And I did wonder, there's one particular line that even I kind of was gasping at, and I thought, did that line make it in the American production? Because that I could have seen this being picketed if that line was there. I don't know how high profile the production was in America, but there is one that, you know, I think you probably know which line I'm talking about, that is, you know, a really kind of, maybe not so much over here, you know, I think I'd have expected, I've probably heard similar said in shows over here, but, in America, that was quite a daring piece of writing.
Well, I think the religious side of it is also interesting, in that it's not just one character. And also, I think that these people who purport to have this religion themselves, by not disclosing something, sort of cross kind of ethical boundaries as well. So I thought that was very interesting. But you're right, we didn't really talk about what is quite an important part of the play, the mother's religious beliefs and how that impacts on everything.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.